Thank you, Lathan, for that very kind introduction. Thank you in particular for the invitation, and thank you to everyone for coming along. I should confess, if you came to this talk because you read the title and didn't read the abstract, I've totally got you here under false pretenses. This was the ultimate, what's it called? But click and bait, bait and click? I can't even remember the word, but it's a swizz. We're not living in the Matrix. Not only are we not living in the Matrix, it's just a stupid question. If you want evidence for why it's a stupid question, Elon Musk thinks we're living in the Matrix. I mean, it's hard to think of a less compelling reason than that to actually explore a topic. Having said that, hidden inside this stupid question is, I think, a very interesting question. And I actually think one of the great open questions in mathematical physics, and that's what I want to talk to you about. So the question that I want to address, twisting the title, is not are we living in a computer simulation, but a more elementary question, which is it possible to simulate the known laws of physics on a computer? And the reason I think this is a particularly interesting question is because there's a mathematical theorem. The mathematical theorem dates back to the 1980s. It's by Nielsen and Ninemiya. And it says very clearly that the answer to this question is no. There is a mathematical theorem which says it is impossible to simulate the known laws of physics on a computer, which of course, taken at face value, tells us absolutely we cannot be living in the Matrix. What I want to do in this talk is partly explain this theorem to you. It's sort of quite an intuitive theorem, so I'll give you sort of a picture view of it. And then tell you about some work which sort of may have appeared a little bit tangential. I certainly didn't advertise the fact it was connected to so much to this problem of the Nielsen-Ninemiya theorem in the paper, but tell you about some work that I've been doing recently whose purpose is to try and find loopholes in the theorem, meaning try and find assumptions at the beginning of the theorem that we can throw away to ultimately find a way to simulate the laws of physics on a computer. Let me start, and maybe the first 15 minutes we'll just be setting the scene, and I'll tell you what the theorem is and what the problem is in particular with doing something that seemingly should be straightforward, just putting the laws of physics on a computer. The issue actually has a very clear beginning. The beginning of this topic is a cold December day in New York City in 1956. When the experiment that Cheng Xiong Wu, who you can see here, the experiment that she had been putting together for 6 months finally gave results. Although the 20th century was an astonishing few decades for particle physics in particular, I think this result is one of the great insights into the world we live in. So I'm sure you all know, but just to set the scene, Chen Xiong Wu did an experiment which is conceptually very straightforward. She took a bunch of cobalt atoms and she watched them die. And she noticed that when the nuclei decay, they spit out electrons because they decay by a beta decay, and they spit out electrons preferentially in the opposite direction to which the nuclei spin, which sounds like a totally innocuous observation. The deep fact is, of course, that had she been doing this this experiment while, for some bizarre reason, looking in a mirror, she would have come to the completely opposite conclusion to what she actually came to. The reason is that if you look at cobalt nuclei decay when in a mirror, the electrons, of course, go in the same direction, but the spin of the nuclei is reversed. It's reversed from being right-handed to left-handed. So to put this in perspective, if you look closely at these two photographs, you can tell which is the original and which I've just flipped using PowerPoint. And Wu's great discovery was that exactly the same is true in nature. If you look closely enough at a subatomic reaction, you can tell which is the original and which, you can tell whether it's an original or whether you're viewing it in the mirror. But by the way, the one way you can tell is the writing is legible on the one on the left, but not on the one on the right. All right. So why is it such a deep insight? Well, it really points directly at what is the most beautiful and striking aspect of the Standard Model, which is the Standard Model is an example of what we call a chiral gauge theory. So again, just some very basics. If you go to the Dirac equation and you look at the Dirac equation for a massless fermion, you will see that the massless fermion splits into two pieces, a left-handed piece and a right-handed piece, depending on how the spin is aligned with the momenta. And Wu's result tells us directly that the left-handed fermions in the Standard Model experience different forces from the right-handed fermions. It's really, as I said, the most striking aspect of the Standard Model. It's certainly the aspect of the Standard Model that connects most deeply with ideas in topology and geometry and deep ideas in mathematics in a way that I'll elaborate upon as the talk goes on. But for the immediate purposes, it's this aspect of the Standard Model which defies computer simulation. And the reason it defies computer simulation is really at the very first step. It's that if you have a chiral fermion or a chiral gauge theory, that's where the left and right-handed fermions experience different forces, you cannot discretize them. That means that you cannot write down a discrete version of those theories where the continuous fields that we know and love are replaced by discrete objects, and more importantly, where the continuous space or space-time that we know and love is replaced by a discrete lattice of points. Of course, if you want to simulate things on a computer, the first thing you have to do is discretize everything in sight. You replace derivatives with difference equations and so on. So even at this first step, you fail when trying to simulate the Standard Model. So what I'd like to do to begin with is just give you a sense for why this is. As I said, that the theorem is remarkably straightforward. In particular, what I'm going to do here is just prove a baby version of the theorem to give you some intuition for what's going on in case you haven't seen this before. All right, so here's on one slide a proof of the theorem. It's a slightly busy slide, so let me walk you along. Firstly, I'm going to prove this theorem not in 3+1 dimensions, but in 1+1 dimensions. So space is going to be a line. The same proof generalizes to higher dimensions. It's just easier here. So what happens? Well, in 1+1 dimensions, a massless fermion doesn't have spin, but there's two possibilities for a massless fermion. It can either go that way at the speed of light, or it can go that way at the speed of light. So this is what becomes of left-handed versus right-handed fermions. In two dimensions, they either become left-moving or right-moving. So already it's a much simpler concept, that the chirality in one dimension is just the way the fermion moves. So what I've got here is on the left-hand part of the slide, I've got the dispersion relation, that's the energy versus momentum, for a single right-moving fermion in 1+1 dimensions. So a few things to note about it. Because it's a massless particle, the energy is proportional to the momentum. So it's a straight line. And because it's right moving, it's a straight line with positive slope. So it just goes in one direction. There's a bunch of ways to see that that's the case. On the left is Hamilton's equation. The velocity is the derivative of the energy with respect to momentum, and velocity is positive for this. In contrast, if you want a left-moving fermion, it just goes the other way. So that's right-moving, that's left-moving. So if you're a continuum person, as we all think we are, there's absolutely nothing wrong with having a single right-moving fermion in 1+1 dimensions. However, if you try to make space discrete, it's no longer possible to achieve this. The same is true if you try to make space-time discrete, but actually just making space discrete is sufficient to see it. And the reason for that is really follows from the basic fact, which I put on the bottom of the slide. So it's sort of number one fact that you need to know in solid-state physics. If it's been a while since you've taken solid-state physics, let me remind you. Make space discrete. So space is a lattice, which is just a collection of points on a line in 1+1 dimensions. Lattice spacing, I'm going to call A. The remarkable fact, which follows from quantum mechanics, is that if space is discrete, momentum becomes a periodic variable. Momentum is compact, it's valued on a circle, and it takes values between minus pi over A and plus pi over A, at least if you set H bar equal to 1. And plus pi over a is the same as minus pi over a. Now, let me give you some intuition for this. If you haven't seen this since you were an undergrad and you've not thought about solid state physics, the converse is something everybody knows because we learn about it in the first course in quantum mechanics. And even if you're a fancy string theorist, you think about Kaluza-Klein reductions every day. If space is a circle, then momentum is discrete. Momentum becomes quantized if space is a circle. So what we're seeing on the bottom of the slide here is really just the Fourier transform of that more familiar statement. Another way of thinking about it is roughly speaking that the lattice breaks translational invariance, and when the momentum is pi over a, the lattice itself can absorb a discrete quantum of momentum and send you back to minus pi over a. That's the reason that momentum is periodic. All right, so very simple fact. Now the point is that you try to combine the fact on the bottom of the slide, the momentum is a circle, with the graph on the left. And you can see the problem immediately. The graph of energy versus momentum should be continuous. If it's not, you get bad things happening, non-localities when you go back to the quantum field theory. But the goal is now to draw a continuous energy versus momentum graph, but with the horizontal axis being periodic. And you can see that what you've got there just doesn't do it. So clearly what goes up at some point has to bend over and come back down again. So simply making space discrete turns the graph on the left into something qualitatively different. It turns it onto the graph on the right. And in fact, if you just take the Weyl equation and do a naive discretization, what you'll find is the energy versus momentum relation has this sine form as written at the top. So it's clear what's happening. If you look at small momentum, you reproduce the continuum result. Small momentum is a linear, get my mirroring mixed up, is a linear dispersion relation that's exactly the same as the continuum. But as you go to high momentum, and I should give you a condensed matter phrase, the circle on which the momentum is valued is called the Brillouin zone in condensed matter physics. So as you go to the edge of the Brillouin zone, what happens is the graph has to curve back down again. This point here is identified with this point here. So the graph is nice and smooth on the circle. But you can see the key fact is that it has to cross the axis for a second time. Has to cross the E equals zero axis for a second time. And it does so for what is essentially topological reasons, although trivial topological reasons here. If you go up, you've got to come back down again. What does that mean? It means that if you try to put just a right moving particle on the lattice, you have some low energy states here, but the lattice will rebel and it will generate for you new low energy states which sit at the edge of the Brillouin zone. So these new states have high momentum, but the momentum isn't the important thing. The energy is the important thing, and the energy is arbitrarily small. So you try to put a right moving fermion on the lattice, you get a new low energy state. And crucially, the graph crosses in the opposite direction when it crosses for the second time. In other words, this one's right moving because the slope is positive, but this one is left moving because the slope is negative. So you can see the problem immediately. The lattice has rebelled. You try to put just a single right moving fermion on the lattice does not allow it, and it spits back a right moving fermion at small momentum and a left moving fermion, which is also massless because it has small energy, arbitrarily small energy, albeit high momentum. So this is called fermion doubling. The additional fermion that you get, I'm going to refer to it both as a doubler and as a mirror fermion as we go along. So we learn two things. We learn that you can't just put a right moving fermion on the lattice. The lattice insists that you have an accompanying left moving fermion. And moreover, if you try to couple the right moving fermion to a gauge field, try to make it feel a particular force, the left mover is going to feel exactly the same force. And it feels the same force because at the end of the day, it's the same field. It's the same field here and here. You can see they're continuously connected, which means that it's not only is it not possible to put just right moving fermions on the lattice, it's also not possible to put chiral gauge theories where right movers and left movers you may have equal numbers, but it's not possible to assign them different quantum numbers under forces. This is the Nielsen-Mia theorem. As you can see, it's a simple proof. It's one of several very simple proofs that one can write down. It generalizes very easily to higher dimensions. It's a fact in all even dimensions that you cannot put chiral fermions or chiral gauge theories on the lattice. This is the obstacle towards simulating our world, because our world is a chiral gauge theory. This is the problem that I would like to at least think about how to overcome in this talk. I'm not going to solve it, I should say. It's one of the great problems in theoretical physics, but I'm going to give you some ideas. This is a good place to pause for questions about the background, if there are any. Everyone is happy. 108 people, you're all happy. All right, let me move on. Before I go on and change the story a little bit, I'm going to tell you about a slightly different perspective, which basically gives the same result, but it'll be useful a bit later.
I see in the chat there are some questions. Are you having trouble unmuting?
Yeah, Jacob, Nicholas, if you want to ask a question, just go ahead.
I see. Craig, I think somehow people can't unmute. Are you still there, Craig?
Yeah, just let me check.
While we're unmuting, let me just finish this story and then I'll take questions.
Okay, so, participants can now unmute.
Okay. So there's a very small variation on this story, which, as I said, is going to be important later. The variation really came out of thinking about continuum physics, ideas of Callan and Harvey in particular. But on the lattice, it was really David Kaplan who had this, what I think is really a fantastic idea. The idea is that you take the world that you want to simulate, let's say it's 3+1 dimensions, our world, and you actually think of a fermion in one dimension higher, 4+1 dimensions. But the extra dimension, you make a finite interval. So the other dimensions are big in some sense. If you're really going to simulate, you want them to be big and say a torus. But the extra dimension is a finite interval. And you put a massive 4+1 dimensional fermion on this interval. And you solve the Dirac equation. And what you find is that the Dirac equation actually has two massless modes from a 3+1 dimensional sense. And the massless modes are localized exponentially on the edges of this interval. So on one left, you get the left-handed chiral fermion, but the doubler now doesn't appear shifted in momentum space, it instead appears shifted in this extra dimension. So the mirror fermion now sits on the other edge of this interval. The conclusion is the same, that if you try to put a left-handed fermion, a right-handed fermion comes along for the ride. The novelty is that it's not shift, it doesn't exist elsewhere in the Brillouin zone. It actually exists in a different higher dimension. And this idea is going to be important later. There were some questions. Jacob, please.
Oh, yeah, hi. Back to your the toy model version of the theorem. So yeah. I'm wondering, say, here that if you also make the time discrete, I don't know, say periodic driving or something like that, then isn't the energy direction also will be periodic? Then you can actually have a dispersion that's just linear, like the left side of the figure.
Yeah, that's yeah. A great question. Sadly, that's not the way it works. That would be very nice, but I think the issue is a Lorentzian versus Euclidean issue. If you make time discrete, it's hard to make Lorentzian spaces discrete. If you have a discrete Minkowski space, you basically don't recover Lorentz invariance in the continuum limit, because as you boost more and more, any discrete lattice gets more and more stretched. Whereas if you have a discrete Euclidean space, if you rotate by 90 degrees, you come back to the lattice you started with. So you have to be in Euclidean space, and then basically the energy versus momentum relation isn't quite the right thing to talk about. So it's a nice idea, but sadly it's a bit more subtle than that.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. In fact, it's worse, of course. You get extra zero modes in the time direction as well as the space direction. There was another question by Nicholas.
So I'm just finishing up my QFT3 course, so it's it might be a little basic, but what does this imply about renormalization schemes? The fact that, for instance, we have, it seems like maybe the finiteness of space is more relevant here than the discreteness, but I'm not totally sure. But I'm wondering, what does this imply about when we try to put an IR cutoff or something on our theory?
IR is fine. By the finiteness of space, you mean space being, space itself being periodic.
Exactly.
That's not an issue. That just makes the momentum variable discrete. And if space is very big, momentum becomes very fine. So no, it's the issue that space is discrete, not the fact that space is compact. But the question about a regularization scheme, a UV regularization scheme, is a good one. And another way of saying this is we have no UV regularization scheme for chiral gauge theories. Certainly not at the non-perturbative level, and I think it's probably true at the perturbative level as well. You can kind of kludge it at one loop and maybe even two loops, but there are no good regularization schemes for chiral gauge theories. It's a big issue.
Okay, fantastic, thanks. Also, I got mixed up my solid state physics apparently with the momenta there.
Marina, you have a question?
Oh yeah, it's about the conclusion. So in principle from this theorem, we cannot simulate like weak forces, but we could simulate everything else, like in principle.
Yeah,
is there any kind of quantifier of how much can we simulate or something?
If you ignore the weak force, you can go ahead and simulate the strong force and QED as much as you like. And of course people do, and it's a huge enterprise. And nature is kind to us because the bit of nature that is chiral is the weak force, and the clue's in the name, it's weak. So you can just do it by hand. You can just do perturbation theory. And so it's not such a pressing issue for particle physics phenomenology. If you care about LHC physics, this isn't a problem. You can just do it by hand. But if you care about more sort of fundamental issues about quantum field theory, or maybe even the standard model, I think it's one of the big issues, big unresolved issues in the standard model. Does that address the question, or did I
slice? Yes. I wasn't great, sure. Thanks.
Hi, may I ask one more question?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, what if we just introduce some term which breaks, does not respect the parity symmetry, where to compensate the fact that our universe is that respecting the parity symmetry?
No, our universe does not respect the parity symmetry. That's where the problem comes from.
So what if we just include such kind of term in the Hamiltonian? Oh, Lagrangian, sorry.
I did. This is what I ended up with. I'm not quite sure what the question is, but the way the world doesn't the way the world violates parity is that there are terms in the Lagrangian where left-handed fermions fuel forces that right-handed fermions do not. And that's what you can't simulate.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. So one question is why. So you have a mathematical theorem, it's kind of nice to build some intuition for what's going on. And there's a very clear reason why this is the case, why the Nielsen-Ninemeyer theorem had to be true. Because if the Nielsen-Ninemeyer theorem was not true, bad things would happen. So let me explain what these bad things are. You see, chiral gauge theories are very delicate objects in quantum field theory. Most chiral gauge theories that you could write down, that is theories where left-handed fermions and right-handed fermions feel different forces, most theories would simply be nonsense. Because when you write down chiral gauge theories, there are a bunch of consistency conditions that they have to obey. They're called quantum anomaly conditions. The anomalies have to cancel. And it means that there's a delicate balancing act. It can't just be that the left-handed fermions feel any old force and the right-handed fermions feel some other force. There has to be some compensation between them. So left-handed and right-handed fermions have to be correlated in some way in the forces that that they experience. Now, there's two ways to satisfy these quantum anomaly conditions, these cancellation conditions. One is that you just shrug and you let the left-handed fermions feel exactly the same forces as the right-handed fermions. In that case, where parity isn't violated, these quantum anomaly conditions are just saturated, sorry, said the wrong word, are satisfied automatically. Alternatively, if you want a theory that violates parity, you have some work to do. You have to sort of set the fermion content up and the force content up in such a way that these anomaly conditions are obeyed. There's a lovely example. Let me give you the example of this. In fact, there's the example is the standard model. There's two ways to think about the example I'm going to tell you about. One is old. It's like 30 or 40 years old. It's been taught in master's classes and quantum field theory classes for decades. The other one I discovered about 18 months ago, and I think it's cute. In large part, I think it's cute because nobody realized this for the last 40 years. So here's the game. You take the standard model with the gauge group that we know and love. You take the fermion content of the standard model that we know and love. And I should say that the story is simplest if you just discount the existence of a right-handed neutrino. With that, here's the game that you play. Assign all the fermions, quarks and leptons, the forces that we know and love under the strong and weak force, which means the quarks experience the strong force and the leptons don't, and the left-handed fermions experience the weak force and the right-handed fermions don't. But next you allow the hypercharge to be anything you like. And by the way, I should say, if there are people in the audience who aren't particle physicists, whenever I say hypercharge, just exchange in your mind the word electric charge. Basically the same thing. So the hypercharge of the known fermions are weird, right? There's a 1/6 in there, and there's a 4/3, and there's a 2/3, and there's a 1, and they're all over the place. The question is, why do they have those particular charges? So the story that people have been doing for 40 years is the following. You allow the hypercharges to be anything, and then you ask which hypercharges obey the quantum consistency conditions that make it a well-defined quantum field theory. There's a bunch of different consistency conditions you get. The hypercharges have to be consistent with themselves, they have to be consistent with the strong force, they have to be consistent with the weak force. And in the past, people, I think quite reasonably, also asked that they were consistent with gravity. If you insist on all those consistency conditions, you find there are exactly two solutions. One of them gives you a standard model which does not violate parity. And the other one, which is the unique solution that violates parity, is the hypercharges that we know and love in the standard model. In other words, if you want a parity violating theory with this gauge group and the matter content, there is no option for the hypercharges other than what we see. It's fixed by consistency alone. The novel idea that we had was the following. We redo it. But we don't insist on consistency with gravity. Now, my motivation for that isn't great. I do want a world that's consistent with gravity, but you know, as you all know, gravity is a little different from the other forces, so it doesn't seem totally unreasonable to discount gravity. However, I discount gravity, but I add something extra. I add that the hypercharges should be quantized. So they should be integers, or if you rescale, they should be rational numbers. So the rather wonderful fact is that if you take the consistency conditions of the standard model with rational hypercharges, you do a change of variables and you find that the consistency conditions require you to find integer solutions to this equation here, x cubed plus y cubed equals z cubed. Of course, it's one of the most famous equations in all of mathematics. This is Fermat's last theorem. And Fermat tells you, really it's Euler that tells you this one, tells you that there is a solution, but it's always a trivial solution. Solutions like 1 cubed plus 0 cubed equals 1 cubed. If you take this trivial solution, you plug it back into that complicated change of variables that we found, out pops the known hypercharges of the standard model. So I think it's a lovely fact that buried within the standard model, the consistency conditions of the standard model, was Fermat's last theorem just sitting there. It's Fermat's last theorem is one way to tell you that the hypercharges have to be the values that they are. All right, so what does this have to do with our lattice? The fact is, the lattice knows nothing about any of this. All of this story of quantum consistency conditions is to do with UV divergences in quantum field theories, at least in some ways of looking at them, how you regulate quantum field theories. It's way above the pay grade of the lattice. Lattice is just quantum mechanics. It's just a finite number of degrees of freedom on a finite number of points. It simply doesn't know about quantum anomalies. It's just got no way at all of reproducing all of the story that I've just told. And so what does it do? The lattice can't spit out an inconsistent quantum field theory. So the way it responds, it basically covers its ass. It always chooses the option number one, that the left-handed fermions and the right-handed fermions feel the same force, because it doesn't know anything about the complications that would be required to get an option number two. Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, nature has chosen option number two. So this is where the tension lies between what's going on with the lattice and what's going on with the world that we see. Any questions about this? I'm going to change gear once again right now. All good? All right. So how do we get around this? Well, the Nielsen-Hinemeier theorem includes the link. It's a theorem. It's a mathematical theorem. It can't be wrong. But whenever there are no-go theorems in physics, the trick is always the same. You look at the assumptions and you figure out which assumption you can do without and cross it out and then see if there's a way to evade it. So here's the Nielsen-Hinemeier theorem in pictures. There's always the doublers, whether they're separated in momentum space in the Brillouin zone or separated in an extra spatial dimension for domain wall fermions. And the particular assumption that we're going to try and throw away is actually one that I think is rarely stated explicitly in the Nielsen-Hinemeier theorem. It's that it relies on weak coupling field theory. And you can sort of see it in the language that I'm using, that the language that I used for this baby proof of the Nielsen-Hinemeier theorem was language of single particle quantum mechanics, energy versus momentum. Moreover, in this old fashioned way that Dirac thought of with negative energy states and a Dirac C and everything that accompanies that. It's simply not the right language when you have strongly interacting quantum field theories. So you get around the theorem by just saying, I'm not going to draw a graph. These graphs of energy versus momentum are single particle ideas. And when you have multi-particle states, which are necessary in strongly interacting field theories, this is not the right language to discuss things in. So the idea is the following, that one turns on some strong interactions localized at the edge of the Brillouin zone, or in the domain wall picture, localized on one edge of the interval. And you want these strong interactions to have the effect that they're going to give a mass to all of the chiral fermions that lived here, all of the doublers. The condensed matter word is to gap, to give a mass is to gap. So that's the goal. It's a goal that was first proposed by Eichten and Preskin in what I think is a very insightful paper from the mid-80s. And it turns out there are two challenges to come with this goal. One challenge is to find a way to turn on interactions that only affect the doublers, but not the guys that you want to keep, whether that's in momentum space or on the domain wall picture. And the other challenge, which is really the one I'm going to focus on, is to find a way to gap all of these fermions, give them a mass, without breaking any gauge symmetry under which these guys are charged. Okay, let me give you an example, and it's an example that we're going to look at as you go along. Suppose you want to put the actual standard model on a lattice. So you take a bunch of fermions here, which are the fermions that we know and love, the 15 fermions, 16 if you include a right-handed neutrino of the standard model. They're charged under SU3 times SU2 times U1 with particular chiral quantum numbers. The opposite fermions sit here, but you want to give all of these guys a mass without breaking electroweak symmetry, which means you don't get to use a Higgs mechanism, because the first thing the Higgs mechanism does when it gives a mass to the fermions we have is break electroweak symmetry. But if you broke the electroweak symmetry here, it would feed in and it would also be broken here. you might be thinking it is broken in our world, but it would be broken at a scale above the TEV. So it wouldn't be phenomenologically relevant. So these are the issues. Find a way to localize the interactions just on the mirrors, but also find a way to gap a bunch of chiral fermions without breaking the gauge symmetry under which they're charged necessarily chirally. So there have been many, many attempts since the Eichton-Preskill approach. I notice in the audience, Eric Poppitz and Simon Cattrall, both of very interesting approaches on this. Eric using overlap fermions, Simon, I didn't add your name, Simon, because it was too recent. Simon more recently using staggered or Kähler-Dirac fermions. All of these approaches share something in common. They try to add interactions here, and the kind of interactions they add, well, you can't add a mass term, because a mass term isn't allowed for chiral fermions, it would break the symmetry. So they all add four fermion terms, or in general, higher fermion, higher dimension multi-fermion interactions. Now, if you know a little bit about quantum field theory, that the first thing that sort of stood out to me when I looked at this, and actually I learned most of this from a lovely review article by Eric Poppitz called Mission Impossible. The first thing that I thought when I saw this was, there's no way that four fermion terms can give a mass to fermions in four dimensions, because four fermion terms are irrelevant. That means that irrelevant terms do not affect the infrared physics. They certainly can't give a mass in four dimensions. Maybe in two dimensions, interesting things can happen, but not in four dimensions. However, you can do things on the lattice that you can't do on the continuum. In particular, you can take the coefficient of this four fermion term and you can crank it up so it's very strong at the scale of the UV cutoff. That means at the lattice scale. If you do that, you don't have anything looking like a continuum quantum field theory. It's strongly coupled at the lattice. But because it doesn't look like a continuum quantum field theory, it can potentially do things that continuum quantum field theories can't. And in particular, it might be able to gap the fermions that sit at the edge, achieving what you want. So that this was the proposal. I think it's a brilliant idea. I think it's probably going to work if you do it right. The trouble is that despite a huge amount of effort, no one succeeded in getting this to fly. Certainly not in the way that I'm describing it here. It turns out if you try it, both fermions get gapped, or neither get gapped, or the symmetry that you wanted to be preserved gets broken. It just seems that somehow it's tricky to find particular interactions that will achieve what you want. I could go into details of why that is, but I think it's fair to say that using these kind of interactions that are strongly coupled with the lattice, it's difficult to make progress. And so far, this particular way forward seems to have floundered on this. Any questions about this? This would be a good time to ask questions. I'm going to shift gears once again. All right, let me move on. So what was the problem? Well, one of the problems in the previous approach is the fact that you're relying on these interactions at the lattice scale. And as soon as you're relying on strong interactions at the lattice scale, at least speaking personally, I sort of lose all intuition for what's going on, because you can't apply continuum quantum field theory techniques. You can't apply ideas that Wilson taught us about RG. Basically, you lose control over everything that you want. So what we wanted to do was to try to find a continuum quantum field theory way to take a bunch of chiral fermions and give them a mass without breaking the symmetry under which they're charged. This was a paper I wrote a few months ago with Shlomo Razamat. There's a sequel coming out sometime soon. So for example, what we would want to do is take one generation of the standard model, now viewed as those doublers, the mirror fermions that we don't want, and find a way to give one generation of a standard model a mass without invoking a Higgs mechanism and without breaking electroweak symmetry. That's the goal we set ourselves. All right, so how can you do it? So here's the general setup. You've got a bunch of massless fermions, and the example I'm going to give you shortly is actually the standard model. So you can think of that if you like. bunch of massless fermions, they transform in some chiral representation of a symmetry group G, but the representation is non-anomalous. That's important for reasons that experts will know, and I'm not going to explain in detail. All right, so how do you give them a mass? I can't write down quadratic terms because the fact it's chiral means that left-handed fermions and right-handed fermions transform differently under G. So if I put together a quadratic term, the usual mass term, it will break G. I can't write down four fermion terms. They're invariant under G if I tie them together correctly, but typically they're irrelevant. In fact, always they're irrelevant, and so they don't do anything.
David, a quick comment.
Simon, yeah, hi.
Yeah, I mean, this statement about irrelevance, of course, is really only true as a perturbative statement. You really don't know, what happens in outside of perturbation theory.
That's one of the goals
of the lattice approach is to try to find, say, a phase transition where that operator is no longer irrelevant necessarily.
That's exactly what we're going to do here. But in order to do that, you have to introduce new degrees of freedom in the continuum. If it's really just free fermions and you add a four fermion term, what scale are they going to gap? The only scale you have is the cutoff. So if you're not using strong coupling at the cutoff, what you're saying is basically the same as what I'm doing here.
Well, could you not imagine some sort of dimensional transmutation where a scale is, arises, which is, not just the cutoff?
And you could add extra degrees of freedom and we'll see an example where something very similar to what you're suggesting actually happens.
Right, anyway.
But I claim you need extra degrees of freedom. If you just got fermions plus a four fermion term, what's the scale? It's the cutoff scale, and the four fermion term has to be of order the cutoff, and then you're back to Eichten-Preskill lattice ideas. All right, so how am I going to do this? Well, I've got to introduce some new degrees of freedom into the game. So what I'm going to have, here's the basic idea, a bunch of massless fermions transforming under G. And then I'm going to add some massive stuff. And the idea of this massive stuff is it transforms in vector-like representations of G. In fact, it has to because it's massive, so I can just give it a mass. I can decouple it if I want just by taking the mass large. But instead, what I'm going to do is tune parameters. So this massive stuff, which is vector-like, comes down and interacts with the chiral fermions that I have. And chiral plus vector, you might think remains chiral, but I'm going to find a way that the massive stuff comes down, interacts with the chiral matter, and everything becomes vector-like and becomes gapped. That's the goal. So this extra stuff that I add, it can include scalars, it can include vector-like fermions. But importantly, if I want to generate some strong interactions in four dimensions, and we're going to need some strong dynamics, strongly coupled dynamics to do this, it has to include some new gauge fields. So
can I just clarify, David?
Maybe
you said this already, but so by vector-like, you just mean not chiral here?
Yeah, vector-like, I mean that if I've got a left-handed fermion in some representation of a group G, there's a right-handed counterpart in the same representation. So I can just give it a mass and remove it. That's what I mean.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
Thanks. All right, so I'm going to introduce some gauge fields. These new gauge fields will not be associated to G. They're kind of just low energy gauge fields that, the standard model that I want floating around at the end of the day. They're going to be associated to some other group H. And this group H has to have a few properties. It has to commute with G. There can't be any mixed anomalies between H and G. These are just the statements that once I've gauged H, G remains a good gauge symmetry and doesn't disappear. And finally, if I want to decouple gauge fields, the way you do it is through a Higgs mechanism for H, not for G. So there's always going to be some scalars that couple to H, which just allow me to take those gauge bosons off to infinity. So this is the rules of the game. In the paper with Shlomo, we have a bunch of examples. We have more examples in a paper that should be coming out soon. But here I just want to run through one example, which isn't the simplest. But it's not far from the simplest. And I think it's by far the most interesting. It's the standard model. So the goal is, can you find a way to give all the fermions in the standard model a mass without breaking this symmetry group? And I remind you, nature chooses a different way. Nature introduces a Higgs boson so that every generation of the standard model gets a mass because SU2 times U1 is broken. But here, my goal is slightly different. It's to give a mass to all of these objects without breaking G. Notice that I can't just write down a mass term because the left-handed and right-handed fermions transform differently. And I should point out that I've actually conjugated the left-handed fermions. In four dimensions, the conjugate of a left-handed fermion becomes right-handed. So everything here is right-handed, just for notational purposes. These are the quarks. You can see the quarks transform in the three bar, the left-handed quarks, because I've conjugated. All right, so these are the quantum numbers of the standard model. And again, sorry, if you don't know, the first number tells you the quantum number under the strong force. If it's one, it's a lepton. If it's three, it's a quark. The second number tells you the quantum number, whether it's charged or not, under the weak force. And then the subscript is the hypercharge, scaled by a factor of six, so they're all integers. All right, so what do I do? Three steps I need, and I can give all of these a mass without breaking G. Let me show you the three steps. Step number one is to introduce some extra massive fermions in vector-like representations. That means they have to come in pairs. Because everything's left-handed, everything's right-handed, the quantum numbers are conjugate. So I can pair these two up because there's a plus three and a minus three. So these two will pair up. The two and the two bar are the same in SU2, that's important. These two can pair up and just get a mass without breaking G. The same for these two, the same for these two. Okay, so three pairs of fermions. Originally I can make them as massive as I like, but I'm gonna bring them down and make them massless, the same as the others. The next step is to note that because I added these extra pairs, there's a new symmetry. In addition to the G symmetry, you see, these two are the same, and these two are the same, and these two are the same. So in addition to G, there's an extra SU2 symmetry that I'm going to call H. And what I'm going to do is introduce gauge bosons for this H. So I'm going to gauge the SU2 symmetry. Notice that what I've got then is an SU2 gauge theory coupled to six doublets. Six because there's two here, there's three here, and there's one here. So at this point, I've got some strongly interacting quantum field theory, SU2 coupled to six doublets. From the perspective of this quantum field theory, there's an SU6 symmetry that rotates all of these. And within that SU6 symmetry, you can convince yourself is the gauge group G that I care about and I do not want to break. Okay, so what happens? Well, if you actually take SU2 with six doublets, it confines. And it's pretty clear that the chiral symmetry, which is that SU6, will be spontaneously broken when it confines. This is standard behavior for any quantum field theory. Confinement typically, but importantly, not always, typically comes with chiral symmetry breaking. It's why pions are light in our world. So that would be bad. If this theory SU2 confines, the SU6 global symmetry would be broken. And in turn, the standard model gauge group would be broken. That's game over. So I do one last thing. I add a bunch of scalar fields. I add a bunch of scalar fields, and in addition, I add an extra Weyl fermion that's an adjoint under this SU2. Now, the reason I do this is because with a bunch of scalar fields, I can tune the couplings so that everything becomes supersymmetric. And the nice thing about supersymmetric theories is that we can solve them. We understand exactly what their dynamics is. They were solved, many of them, 25 years ago. And this particular one has a remarkable property. So it's the supersymmetric theory that's SU2 with six doublets. And Seiberg showed that remarkably, this theory confines, but it does so without breaking its chiral symmetry. In other words, the SU6 global symmetry, which contains this as a subgroup, survives after confinement in this theory. So what actually happens? I've given everything a name, it's a capital letter. You should think about this as a superfield, but if you don't know much supersymmetry, it's not so important. The key point is I've just given things a name, really. So there was SU2 with six doublets. When SU2 confines, the doublets pair up. They pair up to form meson-like objects. And at low energies, what you're left with is just some massless mesons. There's 15 of these mesons, 15 because there's some anti-symmetry at 6 times 5 divided by 2. The beautiful fact is that if you compute the quantum numbers of these 15 mesons, I've listed them at the bottom, under G, the standard model gauge group, they're exactly conjugate to the quantum numbers of the 15 objects that didn't participate in this gauge dynamics at all. That there's 15 because there's 2 plus 6 plus 1 plus 3 plus 3. So what happened? I had a bunch of matter that was in a chiral representation of the standard model. Confinement without chiral symmetry breaking paired up some of them. And what I've left with is matter in a vector-like representation of the standard model. The mesons along the bottom, plus the things that were unaffected by this gauge group. What that means is that if I go back to my original theory and I add a superpotential, which if you don't know supersymmetry, is just a bunch of Yukawa terms. It's nothing complicated. Naively, it appears to be marginally irrelevant, but when you flow to the infrared, the strong coupling dynamics pairs up some of these objects. And what you get in the infrared are just quadratic terms, which are just mass terms. So what we've achieved here is a way to invoke strong coupling dynamics, albeit using supersymmetry, but really as a crutch so that I know what the strong coupling is, so that one generation of the standard model gets a mass without breaking the standard model gauge group. All right, a couple of points. As I just said, supersymmetry was a crutch. It's not that I'm madly in love with supersymmetry, that I want that to be the theory that underlies our world. It's that it gave me a way to give a handle on the strong coupling dynamics that was needed in order to have this effect. It's also noticeable that, that the process is robust. So I know that it happens when I have supersymmetry, but if I softly break supersymmetry and move in the neighborhood of that supersymmetric point, but with a non-supersymmetric theory, this whole mechanism has to still work. It can't change dramatically, basically because what we're left with is a gapped state, and gapped states are robust because you can't change parameters arbitrarily a little bit and have the mass go to zero in that dramatic fashion. So it might be that you can break supersymmetry a lot and this persists, but you can certainly break it a little bit and this persists. All right, so in the paper, we have a whole slew of chiral theories and ways in which to give matter in chiral theories a mass without breaking the chiral group, always by invoking some extra dynamics. Any questions?
Hi, David, I have one. Can you hear me?
Yeah, who's speaking?
This is Cliff. Hi.
Oh, hey, Cliff. How you doing?
Yeah, very much, very nice. I'm enjoying your talk very much. So in this situation that you've assembled everything and you've produced this gap, and then there, if I understood you right, who's light once you're finished?
No one's light. Everything's
nobody's
heavy.
Light.
Yeah, everything's okay. Heavy. Gap. The gap is. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
The gap is set by the strong coupling scale of this gauge group H, multiplied by dimensionless Yukawa terms that I didn't put there because I was lazy. So you have five different mass scales in the game, all set by lambda for A, strong coupling scale for this SU2 gauge group.
Okay, let me think about that for a while. Okay, thank you.
All right. As Cliff's here, I might say that. So I was surprised that we could do this, and I think the folklore. At least I believe this was true until we started thinking carefully about it. The folklore was, I think, that this shouldn't have been possible. So one place where I read this folklore a lot is in string theory model building papers when they're trying to get the standard model out, and they get some extra chiral matter. And they say, well, the chiral matter can't be lifted because it's chiral. It's just not true. If you have chiral matter that's anomaly free, there's some dynamics, and I think there's always some dynamics that will lift it without breaking the group under which it's charged.
Yeah, you put your...
Yes. Oh, go ahead, Cliff.
I was just going to comment that's what's worrying me, is that I feel like there's something that shouldn't be allowed here, and so I'm glad you said that, because it means that that it's I'm going to learn something.
Yeah, no, there are many statements in the literature that says this shouldn't be allowed, and they're simply wrong. And it's that if you have chiral matter that has if it's chiral matter charged under a gauge group, clearly it's anomaly free, but then there's always a way to lift it, preserve it without breaking the gauge group. Yeah.
May I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Do I understand correctly that the logic was if you put a theory on a lattice, you would get maybe a left-hand copy of the fermions that you want, and then a right-hand copy that you would like to get to make heavy.
Yes.
But then wasn't part of the problem that the left copy and the right copy both feel the same gauge forces?
Is there a way to make this is exactly where I'm going for the last 3 minutes of the talk. I'm going back to the lattice. All right. So as Latham kindly reviewed, we had left-hand, we had some original fermions plus some doublers on the lattice. Aikton Preskill tried to use, and many others tried to use, strong coupling lattice techniques to gap the doublers. But now we have a new method to gap chiral fermions. We can do it using continuum field theory. So the question is, can we return to the lattice and maybe use this as a way to solve the problem of putting chiral fermions on the lattice? All right. I'm sort of going to go back to the lattice. I'm actually going to stick in the continuum, but everything I say, I believe, can be discretized on the lattice. So I'm going to work with the domain wall fermions, in large part because the fact the mirrors are separated in space makes it much easier to localize degrees of freedom in space much easier to localize interactions in space than to localize interactions in some point in the Brillouin zone. Quantum field theory is naturally local in position space, not in momentum space. All right, so here's the idea. Let's take the standard model, put all the fermions that we know here, and suffer the fact that we get the conjugate fermions on the other side. And we'll then introduce the gauge group of the standard model, SU3 times SU2 times U1, gauge fields, and the gauge fields are going to live everywhere. So at the moment, we don't have the standard model. We have the standard model gauge group coupled to chiral fermions plus their doublers, plus the mirrors. All right, next. I'm going to add these extra fermions. And the extra fermions, introduce this new SU2. And I put the SU2 everywhere as well. So far, nothing's working out. Everything's coupling to everything. That's not good. I think that was really Latham's point. So what's the last step? The last step is introduce a Higgs field and introduce a Higgs field for the SU2 such that it has a profile in the fifth dimension. So the Higgs field is gonna turn on so that the SU2 is heavy where the standard model fermions are. That means the standard model fermions effectively are not gonna experience this. But then the Higgs field will have a profile. You can see it here. It'll go down to zero. And there'll be a region near the mirror fermions where this SU2 gauge field is massless. Because it's massless, it won't be massless for long. The coupling constant will run in four dimensions. It will become strongly coupled. And we've seen what it'll do. What it'll do is it'll give a mass to everything here. So if I can find a way to do this, to localize the SU2 gauge field on one wall, basically I'm done. I've given a mass to the mirrors using this new technique. No strong coupling on the lattice. All the strong coupling is taken account of by the more continuum field theory, weakly coupled in the IR, weakly coupled in the UV, flowing to some strong coupling dynamics. And I'm left just with the standard model. So what's wrong with this? Well, there's a pitfall. This idea of trying to localize gauge fields just on one wall was discussed in the past. This region where the gauge fields live, it's called the waveguide, for obvious reasons from electromagnetism. And when people studied this in the past, and in particular, it was two papers by Goltermann and collaborators that I have in mind, and I realize I'm over time, so I will finish in 60 seconds. What they found was that there were extra degrees of freedom that live where the Higgs field has that profile, that domain wall profile. Those extra degrees of freedom ruin everything, basically, that they get extra sort of mirror fermions living on this orange wall. And so they came to the conclusion this approach simply didn't work. Well, I think they were way too fast. It's very clear why they got the result that they got. As always in lattice gauge theory, the lattice does whatever it needs to do to avoid an anomaly. You can show that you expect there to be extra degrees of freedom living on this orange slab whenever the fermions on this edge transform in an anomalous representation of the gauge group H. The reason is because if they transform in an anomalous representation, there's basically a 5D Chern-Simons term, and that 5D Chern-Simons term has some interplay with that Higgs field profile, and it gives some extra degrees of freedom here. Now, Goltermann and company could only explore this one fermion at a time. What they could do was put a single fermion on here and say, oh, look, there's an extra degree of freedom on the orange bit. But you can see that that's always going to be the case, that if the Chern-Simons term vanishes because the fermions here are non-anomalous under H, so this K vanishes, you only see that by summing over all possible fermions, which is totally obvious, except Goltermann and company couldn't do it because summing over fermions on the lattice gives you the second big problem of lattice gauge theory, which is a sign problem. You sum over configurations, but in a Monte Carlo simulation, they come with plus signs and minus signs, basically you have no way to go forward. So what I propose, I think is going to be very controversial, I actually think this setup will work very straightforwardly. And in fact, I think there is no fermion doubling problem on the lattice. However, that doesn't mean that I know how to simulate chiral quantum field theories. I don't think there's a fermion doubling problem, but I think the fermion doubling problem just transmutes into another very well-known problem, which is the sign problem. So my somewhat controversial conclusion, you can see it here. I think the fermion doubling problem is easy to solve, but not in a way that I actually know how to simulate quantum field theories with chiral matter, because another equally as difficult problem raises its head. All right, I appreciate that last part was a little bit quick, but thank you very much for your attention. I'm happy to take questions.
All right, thank you for that great talk. To start with, are there any questions from students?
So you mentioned a review paper by the name of Mission Impossible. I tried looking it up and I'm having a hard time finding it. Can you please repeat the names of the author?
Yeah, so you don't want to get the Tom Cruise ones. If you Google mission and then in brackets im and then possible, that should get it. But Eric Poppitz, who is in the audience, is the author, and it's a beautiful review article.
Any other student questions?
I was wondering, when you said you can lift chiral matter, what does lift mean?
Oh, by lift, sorry, I'm speaking too loosely. I just mean to give a mass. Yeah. Condensed matter physicists talk of gapping instead of giving a mass. The idea being that when matter has a mass, there's a ground state and there's a gap to the first state, which is E equals mc squared is the gap. And so by lifting, I meant the same thing. If you think in energy space, you have massless matter, and you lift it to become massive. Yeah. Sorry, I should have been clearer.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Why don't we open it to general questions?
So far we've been assuming like a regular lattice, like what, and with like periodic boundary conditions and all this. But what if you had some like weird topology and like non-periodic lattices?
Firstly, there's no such thing as a non-periodic lattice, and that's called a random collection of points. So the whole point of a lattice is there's a periodic structure. Do you know there is? I've sort of always had a fantasy that maybe you could do designer lattices where where if you want particular chiral fermions, there's a way of matching the chirality of the fermions to the lattice structure itself. Something similar actually happens when you put supersymmetry on the lattice. You have to choose particular lattices so that the SUSY gets twisted in a nice way with the lattice structure. I'd say that's the idea that you could apply this for chiral gauge theories is simply a fantasy. I've made no progress with that at all, but you know, it's something that might be worth playing with.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the finite element things I do in engineering. Yeah, it's okay.
I know nothing about that. Maybe that's an interesting thing to explore.
Okay. Well, it sounds like we may be at the end of the questions, in which case, since we're over time, why don't we thank David once more for a really great talk. Feel free to unmute if you'd like.